This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Patreon supporters. Thanks, guys. Check out the new monthly goal. If you hit it, you unlock a book review and other choice extras at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with our episode.
Is it on the news?
In local news today, bees.
Nope.
Today on The Blotter Presents, we're getting granular. David Granular, that is. Don't get up, I'll fire myself. But before I do, I'm going to talk with a first-time guest about Redford's last acting role, plus a documentary on the Cameron Todd Willingham case that calls arson, quote, science, the death penalty, and Texan state government into question. If David Gran wrote about it for The New Yorker, chances are we're trying to talk about it today on The Blotter Presents, episode 101. Actually, this is the one time I'm not going to be gassing on about that Frederick Bourdain piece that David Gran wrote for The New Yorker. That's called The Chameleon. Y'all can go Google that while I welcome you back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast devoted to the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. I am your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am thrilled to be joined by Omar Gayaga for today's episode. Hello, Omar.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I think that we are doing a little better. Last week's 100th episode was, quote, celebrated with guest Toby Ball with two pretty mediocre properties. I think we're doing a little better. This week, we are talking about two properties sort of semi-derived from David Gran's stories in The New Yorker. So let us get into our most wanted section. This isn't exactly current, but it is, I think, coming to HBO relatively soon. It is available on video on demand, iTunes, etc. It is a movie called The Old Man and the Gun. It's based on David Gran's 2003 article of the same name for The New Yorker. Here is the case file adapted from Wikipedia. Quote, Forrest Tucker was first imprisoned at age 15 and spent the rest of his life in and out of jail. He is best known as an escape artist, having escaped from prison, quote, 18 times successfully and 12 times unsuccessfully, end quote, by his own reckoning. His most famous escape was in the summer of 1979 from San Quentin, when he and two Confederates built a kayak and paddled away in full view of the guards. He was not apprehended for 4 years, during which he and a gang went on a crime spree. Director David Lowery's account of those 4 years-ish, The Old Man and the Gun, is adapted from David Gran's New Yorker piece. Like I said, I had read the piece before. I did know Robert Redford was retiring from acting, but Omar, I don't recall hearing anything about this movie or knowing that it existed. Had you heard about it before we...
Yeah, it kind of came and went. I briefly, I think I saw a trailer for it at the movies at one point and thought, oh, okay, that looks kind of interesting. And I knew the name David Lowery because he's kind of a big deal in the, like, at least the Texas Film Festival circuit. He's done a couple of movies as director that got a lot of attention, like, was it Ain't Them Body Saints and Ghost mm-hmm. Story, and is known for directing these kind of very visually lush, very well-acted films. He did the Pete's Dragon, the Disney Pete's Dragon that was like built, made for sensitive boys kind of.
Yes. He also directed a couple episodes of Rectify, I think, which seems like right in that same lane.
Yeah. He's known for this very kind of languid tone and great acting in his films. And this one, you know, to me, it was no exception. I mean, it's got definitely got some great things about it. I didn't actually read the David Gran piece until after I saw the movie. So I was like, oh, okay, well, that's not at all what I just saw.
Yeah, not really. I adored this movie. I thought it was really great. I think because I was expecting not much, so it exceeded my expectations, absolutely. I liked, like, he got the job done in like 93 minutes. which you almost never see. There's like a million great actors in it. Sissy Spacek plays Redford's love interest. Casey Affleck is the guy who, the law enforcement guy who's looking for him. Clay Davis is in it. Danny Glover is in it. Tom Waits is in it. Glover and Waits are his gang. I just thought it was really good. It didn't try to do too much. It was very charming. The nods to other films in Redford's career, like The Sting and Butch and Sundance.
That montage of photos of all of his escapes that were using, you know, stuff from previous films. I loved that. I thought that was so clever.
Yeah. And at one point, I love that he's actually looking like he's sort of semi trying to escape, and he's out in a pasture, which is where Redford was kind of like putting himself as an actor. That and Danny Glover, like literally being too old for this shit instead of metaphorically. Like, there are just a lot of little nods to the length and breadth of his career that I thought were great. And I also thought that this was some of the most effective use of montaging to sort of make a story manageable of this type that I've seen. It's sort of hard to convey without the visuals, but here's a clip.
Oh, you mean the old guy? Yeah, same story. Small hall, no prints, no ammo, no nothing.
So you got no leads, huh?
What a fucking surprise.
Mainly on account of nobody giving a shit. It's just kind of a funny story.
Yeah, nothing funnier than armed robbery.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of funny, here's where it gets interesting. I told my wife about the whole deal, and I guess she tells her sister, because the next day, her sister calls me and she told me about a thing she read in the paper that sounds real similar. Old guy with a gun.
What's your wife's sister's name? Hello, Marge. I'm calling about this robbery you had on June 8th. Is that case still open? Yes, ma'am. Would you fax it to me? And what do you mean when you say more than one? Two?
Excuse me.
Oh, hi.
Hi. I'd like to open up an account.
Well, great. What type of account do you have in mind?
This kind. This kind. This guy.
That's Tucker showing but not using his gun to various bank managers. I thought this was very effective. What did you think of the movie generally, like the structure and the pacing and stuff like that?
I thought it took its time. I thought it was beautiful to look at. I mean, if you do the streaming of it on, you can get it in 4K on Apple TV or what have you, and it just looks beautiful. It's just really, really well shot. There's a scene at the very beginning where he and Robert Redford and Sissy Spacek first meet, and they go out for a coffee, I guess. And it's just a long scene of just the two of them in a diner just talking, and you're just like, it just feels so reassuring to know like you're in the hands of pros. You know, they know how to do this. They're their acting is just effortless. And you just feel like you're in good hands. And that kind of carries on through the whole film with all the casting and how it's built. I mean, this is a really good filmmaker and a lot of material to work with. To me, it was sort of like the film seemed to focus a lot more on those couple years of robbery versus all of the escape stuff, which kind of ends up being more of a coda at the end of all of the kind of montage of the escapes. So, it focuses on those years and kind of... the gentleman bank robber, which is my only major quibble with the film, is that it's like bank robbery as a viable retirement career option. Like, oh, sure. And it treats it more like a hobby than anything else, like kind of a slightly dangerous hobby.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about that aspect of it, actually. The David Gran story, I mean, that'll be linked in the show notes, of course, and that's sort of more micro about how he accomplished various things and talks more about his process. They do it a little bit in this film, but I wondered what you thought about the idea that there is an appeal to both escape stories and bank job stories because they are not, because you do have this like more gentlemanly or courteous, like less lethal component to it, hopefully. So we can sort of revel in their exploits while telling ourselves that nobody gets hurt. But at the same time, and this is mentioned in the grand story at some length, and also there's a composite character in the film, not really a composite, but sort of a telescoping of the experience of one of Forrest Tucker's kids, played by Elizabeth Moss. Did you think that that was sort of the right angle to take on this, the fact that like these aren't really victimless crimes after all, and he can be as gentlemanly as he wants, but he's still a thief who traumatized people during bank robberies?
Yeah,
do you think that was a good balance there?
For a film, yeah, I thought it worked for the purposes of the film. What really kind of rang false to me once I had seen the movie and read the article was, yeah, that kind of trail of destruction that he left behind with his family and the wives that had no idea who he was. I think he was married 3 times, and all 3 of them, didn't know what was happening until the cops showed up. And that feels very glossed over in the film. I mean, the article, shows him kind of at the end of his days in prison, regretful and really, looking back on his days as seeing, the damage that he did and the regret that he had. And the film, there's no regret. I mean, the film ends with him pretty remorseless and sociopathic, yeah. I guess. So that was the one thing that really clanged for me as like the idea that he was just able to leave these families behind and move on and not really look back until the very, very end of his life, which we don't get to in the film.
Yeah. I think that was a choice that Lowry had to make in terms of, last week we were talking about the film Devil's Knot and how that case, the West Memphis 3 case, is so sprawling and so heavy that if you don't narrow your focus enough and just choose to leave a lot of things out and stay in a pretty narrow lane in terms of what you're trying to explore or convey, then you just like kind of lose control of it and it turns into like a long listicle. So I can see why Lowry glossed certain things or just tried to keep everything in one time frame. But it is worth mentioning, certainly in the article, there's more made of sort of law enforcement's contention that like he did traumatize people, and not just people he knew who he married under a false name. Like a bank robbery is scary, and he did it a shitload of times. It doesn't matter. I liked that there was a relationship conveyed, sort of I don't know what the expression is. I guess it's sort of like a cat and mouse game, but the film does spend a lot of time with John Hunt, played by Casey Affleck, who is the guy who's trying to catch Forrest Tucker, and does spend some time with the idea that they, Tucker and Hunt, know each other, even if they've never met before. There's a sort of mutual respect at work. Here's a clip. We can talk about it in a second.
So old men robbing banks, it seems like they'd be fairly conspicuous. Any idea how they gotten away with it for so long?
Well, no, but frankly, they have a whole lot more experience robbing banks than we do catching them.
Think you'll be the one to catch them?
I think that any of these fellas here who put in long hours and done some real hard work would like to do the job. But yeah, I won't lie, I'd love to slap the cuffs on them myself. I hope that happens. I hope I get the chance.
Here's hoping time doesn't catch up with them before you do.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Detective.
They're sort of much made of, in a couple of on-the-nose dialogue moments with Hunt's kids, who those little actors are actually really good and natural, but they're given some chewy dialogue where they're like, if you catch him, then you won't need to catch him anymore. Like, then you'll have nothing to sort of live for as a cop. What did you think about that relationship? Because in the clip we just heard, they're kind of like watching each other through the TV during this interview, if that makes any sense. It's well done, but I just wondered what you thought of that aspect of it.
Yeah, there's a really good bit in the film about Robert Redford character leaves behind a $100 bill kind of to him, like a little note to him from the Over the Hill gang, which is what the police had, you know, dubbed them. And I couldn't tell from the article if that was a real detail or if that was just something that they came up with for the film. But that was a cute little thing that they could kind of call back to later when he's caught. The one thing that really stood out to me toward the end was the wife, John Hunt's wife, at the end when they catch him she says, you know, what's going to happen? He's like, oh, we'll probably go to prison. She's like, that's too bad. It's like, well, what do you want them to do with him? I mean, he's going to prison. That detail really stuck with me, is that even the wife of the cop after him is like, oh, don't send him to prison. And that's another detail that kind of clanged for me, was like, you know, that he fits this mold of the gentleman, grandfatherly, doesn't want to hurt anybody guy robbing banks, you know, with the same kind of sympathy be afforded to him if he was an older black gentleman, or if he was, you know, someone else who wasn't, you know, who looked like, you know, had piercing blue eyes and looks like Robert Redford. So that was another thing that was like, yeah, no, that's not really.
You wonder what it would be like if they made like a sort of this into a trilogy, and then the other two parts of the trilogy were from the perspective of the Danny Glover character and the Tom Waits character.
How was this for you?
Because you didn't get a New Yorker article. You're just some guy.
Yeah, and apparently, like, at least one or two of them was still out there at the time of the article. Like, they weren't all caught, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Part of me, there is something, like, in the cultural psyche that, like, you do root for this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm not sure why that is psychologically, what it is about that kind of gentleman outlaw that, I mean, maybe it's just as simple as that.
Well, it's like geriatric Catch Me If You Can. Like, it's going for that kind of zippy, you know, kind of heroic, romantic tone of crime, which, you know, that's definitely a lane that you can go down, and that's what this film does. So it does that very, very, very well, with some very charming actors and some really great filmmaking. There's even that bit, that kind of Miller's Crossing kind of looking bit where he's in the car in a flashback being chased by cops, and the money flies out of the trunk. You know, this is a beautiful shot. It's
so good.
It doesn't get much more romantic filmmaking than that.
Yeah. And even when he's being caught, he's sort of reveling in this part of the process. Like, he likes the processy parts of a bank robbery story as much as we do, even though he's in it and he's getting arrested. Possibly because he's like, well, escape number whatever, 18, coming right up.
Yeah, there's there's a lot of efficiency in the film. And like you said, it's a solid hour and a half and doesn't feel like they waste a lot of film. But there's a bit right toward the end where he's back with Sissy Spacek after getting out of the joint. And, you know, he sees a Brinks truck driving by and just kind of gives it a look, and she gives him a look, and that's all that scene is. And it's great because it's like they don't have to say anything. Like, you know exactly what she's thinking, you know exactly what she's thinking. And that, to me, is really nice, efficient, great filmmaking.
Yeah. Just trust the actors. And at the same time that you have this pretty fun geriatric Catch Me If You Can story, like you said, there's the meta story of everyone in the company sort of enjoying this process of making this movie and kind of watching the actor at work, not just the character. So... I enjoyed that part. Like, I always like, you know, series finales, even for shows that I don't watch, because you can feel the cast kind of just enjoying being together for the last time. And this felt like that. Richard Brody wrote a love letter of a review about the movie for The New Yorker, actually, and was talking about how one of the things that is so successful about it is this sense of intimacy that you have among the characters like among themselves, but also this feeling that you have with them, like that you have sort of a relationship with them, that he's very good at creating a feeling and a shorthand for who these people are and how they relate, not just to each other, but to us. So I've one more clip, and this is after they've just gotten sprayed with Buckshot, the Over the Hill gang. And the setup, they're like in some motel. Redford is drinking a beer. And Waits is like picking Buckshot out of Glover's like belly fat, basically. And they're
love
just
handle,
like,
yeah.
He's like, they took off my love hand. And they just the joking around that they're doing, it works on both the film's level and that meta level of the, you know, these old actors just like enjoying their time together. And again, it's a little hard with only an audio clip to convey it, but let's see how we do with clip four.
He took off one of my love handles. I never actually finished medical school.
We have some breaking news to tell you about right now.
That's coming great. From the next room where Redford is just like unconcerned drinking a beer. He's like, okay, they got this. I don't need to be in there freaking out. Like, I don't know. There's just something great about that, especially in an American film that tends to just prioritize like poreless youth over seeing experience in the actors' faces and having them be just a normal, appropriate age. So this was really a departure, I think. Like,
yeah, I think he's supposed to be like, Redford's supposed to be 67 or something in the film. Like, no.
Yeah.
That's not what his face tells us.
No.
I'm loving this era where Tom Waits can sort of parachute into a film for like 5 minutes or 10 minutes and just completely be wonderful. Between this and Buster Scruggs, I thought he's fantastic in both of them.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, like I could do with that like two or three times a year. Just, you know, 1 5-minute Tom Waits appearance in whatever movie. I don't care what. But
wonder if they're like, it's like a pitch meeting and they're like, you know, and the character who's doing kind of a Tom Waits thing, and Tom Waits is like, I'm not busy. I can do a Tom Waits thing for you.
I'll do it. Sure. I'll go be a prospector. Why not?
Yeah. This movie is great. I really recommend it. This was, I think a great way for Redford to step off the acting stage. Certainly though, the fact that he's like aged down even in this final role, I chose to take as a nod to The Natural, where the like in his late 40s Robert Redford was supposed to be playing a 22-year-old at one point. Not enough Vaseline on a long enough lens.
I'm really surprised this didn't get any, I don't, as far as I know, didn't get any Oscar nominations. I mean, I thought at least for acting or at least for something, it just, or Sissy Spacek for supporting something. Like, this seems like exactly the kind of Oscar Beatty type movie that is actually good, that actually deserves something. And you know, you had something like Green Mile kind of clean up, and then this just flies under the radar. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. I feel like it might have been nominated for a couple of Golden Globes. Like, I think Spacek was nominated for a Golden Globe. Say something super interesting while I look that up.
Oh, I've got it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Actually, Redford was nominated for Best Performance by an Actor in a Motion Picture, Musical, or Comedy.
Wow.
So I guess comedy. And then the AARP Movies for Grown-Up Awards, of course.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there you go. We'll take it. Even the score was good. I am surprised that this didn't get more attention, but hopefully it will now. It's definitely worth the price of rental. I thought it was thoroughly enjoyable. As often happens with true crime properties, you do have to, you know, you have to remember that there were victims here, and like these are felonies. This is pretty serious, but I think it has the right amount of humor, dark humor, doesn't take itself too seriously. And, you know, I feel like also I've just been head down for the last few episodes in glorified serial killers with Ted Bundy and the Central Park Five, just the injustice of that entire situation. And this was kind of a nice, lighter thing to engage with. Unfortunately, it's not going to last in this episode of The Blotter Presents, I'm sorry to tell you. But yeah, I'm super glad that I got to watch this.
And me too. Thank you, Sarah.
Else on this one?
I would have completely missed this movie if we hadn't been discussing it. So thank you. Thank you. It was a really wonderful way to spend a Sunday night.
Yeah, it was really fun. The cold case is not going to be fun. Buckle up, folks. There is actually a scripted take on this case that we tried to watch, Omar and I. We tried to go and see it because it just landed in theaters last month, but we missed it. More on that in a moment. What we're actually discussing is a documentary from 2011, mm-hmm. 2012. It's called Incendiary, The Willingham Case. You can find it on whatever iTunes is called now. You can find it on Vimeo. It is out there. We will also link to the relevant grand piece, which was called Trial by Fire and came out in 2009. That'll be in the show notes. Here is the case file. Cameron Todd Willingham was executed by the state of Texas in 2004 for a 1991 Christmastime fire in Corsicana, Texas, that killed his three baby daughters. Arson investigators claimed the evidence that the fire was set intentionally and that this was done by Willingham was clear. Jurors agreed, as did Willingham's defense attorney. We'll get into it. But actual scientists have felt since before the state of Texas took Willingham's life that he was not responsible. Willingham's plight turned into finger-pointing soon enough at bad science, poor training, political footballing, and the death penalty itself. David Grand wrote about it in a 2009 piece called Trial by Fire, and it's a preoccupation of nonfiction storytellers. It's been on Frontline twice, and it was turned into a recent feature, like I said, starring Laura Dern. Unfortunately, the film version of Trial by Fire bolted from area theaters in two states before we could see it. So we went with this documentary, which covers a lot of the same ground as the Grand piece. Omar, did you read the Grand Trial by Fire before you watched this documentary or after?
Yeah, I had read the piece a long time ago. This is a case that has gotten a lot of attention in Texas, here in Austin. I mean, I'd heard of the case and I'd read the story. And when I read the story, I was just dumbfounded. I just, like, it was an ongoing kind of legal battle even after he was executed, spoiler. You know, it was one of those cases that, you know, that if you pay attention to the news in Texas, you couldn't avoid it. It keeps coming up and bubbling up every couple of years as there's appeals and exoneration attempts. I remember reading it probably maybe the year that story came out, which was in 2009. So yeah, I was well aware of this case for a long time and was continuing to follow it. And just remember just reading the story and just being completely just dumbfounded at what was happening. And then, you know, following it after that, because every time that I would hear the name or it would come up, I was curious about what was happening with it.
Mm. And you actually suggested this case first off as our topic. Any particular reason, or it was just a local case? I mean, this became a national case pretty quickly, actually.
Partly because of the Trial by Fire movie that was coming out with Laura Dern. I had been seeing trailers for that, and then also just that, you know, as a father of two daughters, I remember reading it, and I think my daughters were probably a year or two old when I read the story. Oh, so it was especially horrifying to read about this fire that killed, you know, three, you know, a toddler and two twin infants, and then the father being blamed for it, which is like my worst nightmares. not only did I not do it, but now I'm being imprisoned for killing my own children. Like, that is, you know, a horrible nightmare. I'd always had curiosity in this case because it hit so close to home.
There is something about these, like, fire cases with babies that it's like, after you've spent a couple of hours with it, you have to just, like, go, like, pet a cat or find a flower or something. Like it just gets in your head and starts pulling you down. There was a semi-similar case close to here. Stamford, Connecticut is in the tri-state area. It's known as the Stamford Christmas Fire. There were some fireplace ashes that had not been dealt with correctly. Three girls died. They were grade school age, a set of twins and an older sister. Same kind of thing. I used to live near the Brooklyn Cemetery where they were buried, and I would pass them on my old lady walks, and I would always tell them not to stay up too late. It was sort of my little tradition with them. I didn't know the family or anything about it, really, but there's just something about these cases there's a sustain to them that is really sort of hard to deal with. So
you'll hear about these cases in Texas where, you know, like four or five kids in a trailer park, you know, in trailer are, you know, with a grandmother taking care of them, die from a fire or something electrical or something like that. It happens all the time. And it's just absolutely horrifying every time you read about it. Like the first 5 years of being a parent, those stories seem to always get in your face somehow. Like seem to like, oh God, not the, you know, and you have to sort of shield yourself from some of those stories the first couple of years of parenting, because it can completely demoralize and drain you.
Yeah. With that said, both the Gran article and this documentary are, I think, good at not, given how much of it is devoted to the fact that bad arson science and training led to Willingham's conviction, imprisonment, and execution. So, of course, they do have to get into some of the details. They do a pretty good job not lingering too much on the really wretched aspects of it. Instead, they give a lot of camera time to the great Gerald Hurst, who is this, like, not self-taught exactly, but he's like this Renaissance science man.
Like a PhD in, what is it?
Yeah,
like
chemistry from Cambridge. Chemistry. Yeah. He's not fucking around, this guy. And he is a very soothing talking head interviewee, I find, because he has that, I don't really know how to put it. My dad looks and sounds nothing like the guy and is not a scientist, but there's something about the like mellow authoritative delivery that they share. So let's hear a clip. Here is Hurst talking about sort of advances in forensic rigor around arson. I'm not sure how else to put that, but here's the clip.
The science first really made its impact beginning in 1992 with the first edition of NFPA 921, a guide to fire and explosion investigation. NFPA 921 took the unqualified position that the scientific method should always be used. The result has been, if you look at statistics on arson in Texas, it seems that the number of arson cases is down. It's not because there are fewer arson cases. It's because there are fewer bogus arson cases.
And this is, you know, the year after this fire. But Willingham is still, you know, he's still alive. What did you think about this documentary overall?
I thought it was a good kind of primer on the case. If you had not read the Grand piece, and if you weren't familiar with it at all, it kind of sets up, you know, here's what happened. Here's kind of all of the aftermath that happened even after Willingham was executed, and does a really good job of laying out sort of the Texas political kind of motivations behind all that, and then what happens with the fire commission and everything after. Like, I thought all that was really well done. Some of the things I had an issue with early on were just had more to do with framing and how each side was presented. I thought the way the Willingham's lawyer was presented so differently from everybody else. You know, like he was so set up to look like, you know, a hick. You know, and the twist in this is that Willingham's own lawyer believes he did it and kind of keeps hinting that he knows stuff that he can't talk about, that he, you know, from attorney-client privilege. So, you know, he's dead set that, you know, yeah, he did it. He's guilty. He was a monster. Why are we even still talking about this? But they film him, like, I guess, on his ranch with roosters crowing the entire time, you know, like punctuating every sentence.
And he's wearing like a straw cowboy hat. We do have a clip of that. So let's jump ahead to clip 8 where this guy, Martin, I agree that the framing of him is, I think just including his comments would be plenty withering on its own, and you don't need, like, just ask for another take where, you know, country rooster come to town is not interfering.
It really made me wonder, like, did he choose that location? Did he say, oh, just come to my ranch and film me outside? Like, or because the other talking heads are all in these, you know, very nice offices with their law books and everything behind them.
Yep.
Like, he's the only one filmed, you know, out of context.
And even the quality of the video is, like, cheap. Like, I think he was shot on video and the others were shot on film. Like, it just looks,
and it's close, everything's close up on his face, whereas the others are, you know, full body shot. So, like, even that kind of difference in framing did not seem cool to me. Just that, okay, fine, you know, he sounds like a loon, but you don't have to film him like a loon too to make that case.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, he's the worst. He's got that all sewn up. But anyway, here's a clip.
So we had no expert on our side. Willingham's statements were grossly inconsistent and illogical. And Vasquez and Fogg did a very good job. We did the best we could cross-examining them. And so we relied on cross-examination primarily.
That's 3 times of seriously like 7 in the sequence. I mean, and it's worth noting, since the rooster was not really trying to let anyone listen to that, that, like, he'd just gotten done saying, like, well, you know, it's pretty tough when the experts that you hire say that it's arson. And it's like, well, you know, zealous defense, maybe find another expert. It doesn't really seem like Martin tried all that hard to mount a defense, primarily, I think, because he didn't believe that Willingham, you know, that it could have been an accident or that there was any possibility that he didn't do it. And I think there are some class issues here that the front line definitely gets into that. And
yeah, there's a lot about how, you know, he was a piece of shit to begin with, so why wouldn't he have done this? There's a lot of, you know, he abused his wife, he was not a great guy, he, you know, had a lot of run-ins with the law. So, you know, it follows that he would murder his own 3 children? Not really. That's something that keeps coming up, is just that he already was considered a bad person, you know, before all this happened. And, you know, and at some point, his wife, who had defended him, you know, right after it happened, you know, changed her tune and then later said, you know, that no, he did do it, and he even confessed to me that he did it before he was executed. So there's that, and then there's also the, you know, the lawyer saying that, you know, he's privy to information about it that he can't share. So, you know, the 2 accounts of basically saying he admitted he did it, whereas everything else, you know, in all of his correspondence and public statements were that, you know, that he was innocent right to the end.
Right. I mean, the circumstances of the fire, like, I am not a scientist. I'm also not a psychologist. I will say that they showed a presser with the ex-wife, Stacy, towards the end. That also was framed in such a way to kind of point up, it, you know, her, like, outsider status in the system. And it's sort of like, is this the lipstick narrative that I would go with for this presser? No, it isn't. But I did kind of feel like we were supposed to think that be thinking about her being trashy and not about how difficult this is for her to go through, and that whatever she is believing about what happened, if that makes it easier for her to get from one end of a day to the other with this, I don't judge her. I'm not sure why she chose to believe this, but that's another instance where I think there was some like classist asterisking that was happening that I wasn't a huge fan of.
Yeah, and I think in that case, you know, she was abused by him. You know, her whole family thinks he did it. The state thinks he did it. He goes to trial and is convicted of it. You know, I think by the time it came out that no, this science is junk science, she was already well convinced that he did it and had made up her mind of that. So, you know, and same with the lawyer. I think by the time this contrary evidence comes to light, they've already made up their minds and are not going to be convinced, you know, regardless of the evidence.
Yeah. The film does do a good job sort of explaining in a way that's clear and efficient why the evidence and the way it was presented is not evidence and is not correct. And also kind of clocks the fact that like the so-called arson expert is using Willingham's like affect at the scene as an indicator for arson, which is not necessarily appropriate. So here is clip 7 on that point.
He said in his report that he had 20 indicia of arson, but most of his indicia were irrelevant. They're things like behavior of the witness. They expect people to behave normally when their house is burning down and their children are dying. Nobody behaves normally. There is no norm.
Thank you. And I would say, pursuant to what we were just saying about Willingham perhaps having admitted it to people, is that we all know about false confessions and the pressures of you know, ADSEG incarceration on the psyche. So even if he had done it, I'm not sure that I would believe anything except my first instinct looking at the case, which is if there was a space heater anywhere in this story, the fucking space heater did it.
Yeah, I put in the doc for this episode that I grew up in South Texas where the winters are so mild that really we don't have good ways of dealing with cold weather. So we have these, you know, janky space heaters that only turn on once or twice a year, you know, when it's like 50 degrees and we're freezing. And, you know, I literally, this is true, I burned my butt on my grandmother's space heater once just sitting on it, you know, and I remember having these exposed open flames, you know, in the living room or the bedroom of my grandmother's house. You know, I could have stuck a blanket in there. I could have stuck a piece of paper in there. I could have, you know, as a toddler, could have gotten into all kinds of trouble, you know, with playing with fire that was just right, that I wasn't, you know, used to playing, you know, having around. So it follows that, you know, the 2-year-old could have easily, you know, accidentally put a blanket in there or stuck a slipper in there or any, you know, and we don't really get to that in the documentary till toward the very end. So, you know, I spent a big chunk of the documentary saying, well, if he didn't set the fire, then what happened? Was it electrical? And I think they dismissed electrical early on and then come back to it and say, oh no, it could have been electrical because there was a lot of exposed copper wiring in the house. So yeah, that was a question I kept having as I was watching it was, okay, you know, like the OJ thing, if, you know, if he didn't do it, then who did do it or what did happen? And it seems toward the end of the film that, yeah, it was probably a space heater or electrical if not Willingham.
Yeah. I mean, I have to think that it was that, like, it, you know, there were a couple of years where the house was so full of cousins that I was on a mud porch. Like, Jersey used to get pretty cold in December, and I would wake up on Christmas morning super excited to, you know, see what Santa brought, and then I would have to hope that it was a sleeping bag because the whole side of mine had melted because I rolled over onto the space heater. Like, I just don't think there are any safe space heaters at any time that's in the story. I just feel like that has to be the reason because I don't know, like, do I want to have Willingham over for a barbecue? No, not really. But there's a big leap between, you know, that guy's an abusive asshole to that guy will light his children on fire. Like, I don't see how you see space heater and then jump to the other thing, frankly.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, but yeah, that structurally, I think they could have done perhaps a better job of laying out, you know, the actual substance of the case against him up top and then taking it apart. But I think they did a very good job throwing all kinds of shade at the so-called expert panels put together to deal with this and the people who they put in charge of it and how utterly non-transparent everyone was being about this process of reviewing this case. What did you think of that part?
Oh, I loved it partly because I actually know some of the reporters that were in that room.
I was going to ask about yeah. that. You have a clip and I was going to ask, but anyway, go on.
Yeah. Corey McLaughlin, who I used to work with, is one of the reporters that's standing there like dumbfounded as the guy's like, yeah, not only am I not going to answer your questions, I'm going to be shitty about it. And like Stephen Kratak was someone who I worked with who covered the case. They show his byline and Statesman. So oh my God, I've been there, you know, where you're standing in a press conference and this person is just completely stonewalling and you know why they're stonewalling and they can't say it. And it is a perfect encapsulation of what it's like to be a reporter when someone is completely lying to your face or just trying to cover something up.
And yeah, it's just being a total Sarah Sanders about it. Let's hear a clip. And then there is someone that we see sort of over, this guy, John Bradley's shoulder. He's a former prosecutor, I believe, who was put in charge of this.
By Governor Rick Perry sort of cleared out three people from this commission and put in his own people, including this John Bradley guy, to be in charge of it. So right as they were about to take on the Willingham case.
Yeah. And they, like, the film crew for this film was, like, kicked out of a hearing that was supposed to be open because it was the full panel. Anyway, the camera is shooting over Bradley's shoulder, and this one reporter, is that Corey? Who just starts laughing at the end because he's like, "You're an asshole."
No, Corey wouldn't do that. it might be someone else. Yeah, let's hear it.
All right.
Will you guys post the times and meeting places of the panels, especially when you're on the investigative panel?
If they choose to do so.
Would you choose to do so?
No, I don't think that is in the best interest of trying to move forward.
Why not?
Because the ability to discuss and resolve these issues requires us to have those discussions in private. All of our issues will be released publicly during full commission meetings.
Mr. Brett, let me ask one more time. Why not establish timetables or milestones for getting trial transcripts, videos, and moving this case forward? It's the biggest investigation you guys have.
I don't have a different answer than the one I gave last time.
Which is?
I gave it last time and I have it on the microphone.
All right.
When will the panel meet? That's all I have. Thank you.
It's a little hard to hear, but he's basically just like in this Moebius of unresponsive responses.
Yeah.
He's just so why won't you open this up to the public? Well, that's a decision for the panel. Well, what do you think the panel's going to decide? Well, I don't know. We haven't met yet. Well, then why not make it transparent? Well, that's up to the panel. And he's just getting increasingly agitated when the reporters are like, well, what would be the harm? Why couldn't you suggest it?
Yeah, that is the exact feeling of having a sort, you know, having someone you have to talk to stonewall you and not give you the information you need, and by extension, you know, to the public as well. Like this was very much like, we're going to bury this case, we're going to delay and run out the clock and not get to it, you know. And by the way, our next meeting's not for 4 months, so sorry.
Yeah, and where did they put the meeting?
Oh, in Harlingen, Texas, which is, you know, very, very southern tip of Texas, where all these experts who live in Houston or, you know, it's, you know, 6-7 hour drive, you know, and not very many flights that way. So, yeah, making it as inconvenient as possible for these people to show up and get anything done.
Yeah. I mean,
and this was an election. And I believe it was an election year, too, for Rick Perry, who ran.
Yes.
Who is the most He ran the most terms of any Texas governor and was very, you know, his reputation was very tough on crime. And they, there's actually some clips of Evan Smith interviewing him in the documentary, you know, basically saying, oh, you know, we don't have any innocent people on death row. And it's like, well, what about this person? He's like, that same, you know, debate moment of like, of, you know, if you've seen Rick Perry have that kind of brain fart. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, there's that. And he's like, well, that was before my, you know, before I was governor. that is Rick Perry in a nutshell.
Yeah. I mean, I could act like I'm shocked by this level of, you know, state government shenanigation, but I am from New Jersey, so I am not shocked at all.
No, it still happens, and we still have this thing where, like, wait, what? They replaced all these experts with people that are that they're friends with and political cronies. Okay, yeah, I guess that's what we do here.
Yeah, and then the camera crew had to appeal to some like state board of like the open meeting statute, and had to get like the basically the Texas Rangers to escort them back into this meeting. Like, you know, if you're doing such a great job there, Bradley, why not let the public in? But I thought that was a very elegantly done, like the footage used to illustrate what the truth is up against when it comes to this case and the frantic ass covering and obfuscation that was happening even after Willingham had already been executed, possibly especially for that reason. I thought it was good. I think maybe a slightly different ordering of some of the footage, but that part of it, I think, is where Incendiary shines.
Yeah, and the thing that I found a little bit unsatisfying was that it kind of cuts off as this thing is still in progress. I mean, that, you know, at some point you have to kind of cut bait on the documentary and finish what you started. But even, you know, the Chyrons at the end, you know, are basically like, this is still in progress. This case is still, you know, going through these commissions. And, you know, so we're kind of left with like, well, it's still not over. It's still going on. And I haven't kept up with it as much since the documentary came out. So, but I know that some things have happened since then. One thing I thought it also did really well was as they kind of get into the weeds with all this kind of legal and commission and Texas politics stuff toward the end, you still get a couple of glimpses of the family members of Willingham, you know, speaking at these hearings. And you still kind of carry over some of that emotional weight, lest it get into the weeds of you know, the political stuff.
Yeah. I believe this is, our last clip is his cousin?
Maybe. Yeah.
Sister? Cousin? I think it's his cousin. And this is some, grade A uncut Southern passive aggression happening right here. Where she makes a very good point about the difference between legality and justice, and then she reassures the commission that she knows that they're going to do the right thing, free of outside influences and agendas. Here's our last clip.
He says, it is a legal system. There is no justice to this. There is no reason why we cannot have both. We can have a legal system that is justice. And you people here, I want to thank you, because you're going to get to the bottom of it in spite of outside influences.
And the narrator's really, like, they're not going to get to the bottom,
like,
of it.
I'm sure you have agendas that you can put aside. And I was like, oh, this is my mother-in-law. Absolutely. I'm sure you'll be here right on time for Thanksgiving dinner. Like, okay, got it, Miss Evelyn.
Bless your hearts. Yeah, I think for when it was made in 2011, and for what was happening in the case at the time, which was getting a lot of attention from the Texas media, at least, like, I think it does a good job kind of rounding everything out. I mean, like I said, the only things that I would nitpick is just kind of the framing of the talking heads, just a little bit of how things are put together in what order. But it's a very compelling case. I mean, you could make 10 documentaries from this one case. There's just a lot going on with the class issues you mentioned, and, you know, the science aspect of it. And, you know, this current thing that we're in about just denial of science of like, okay, sure, you have your facts, but we believe otherwise. It's like that whole climate of denying scientific information.
Yeah. And that, you know, arson investigation is more an art than a science. Like, well, if you're going to put someone on death row, you need to have it be all science, no art. That's my feeling. Yeah, this is very good. This is a well done documentary. There is, like I said, I had the same sort of nitpicks as you. I also think that if you have read the David Grann, this followed it in terms of like the actual substance of a lot of the comments, closely enough that you don't need both. So if you have already read the Grann or you're sort of like reading that in preparation for watching along with us on this, I'm not sure you need it. I think you can do one or the other. Many of the same experts and case figures quoted in the Grann piece are in this and are saying much the same thing, sometimes verbatim. I'm sure Dr. Hurst is just sort of like, he just has an, you know, autopilot for his comments on this at this point. But it's very good. And we'll have a link to it again in the show notes. And you can find it pretty much anywhere that you stream movies. It's on Vimeo, it's on iTunes. And that Frontline re-airs occasionally, and you can watch that on pbs.org, I think, for free through your cable provider. Anything else on this one?
No, I think we well covered it.
All righty. Omar, where else can listeners find you and your works and days?
Oh, okay. Well, lately I've been writing some stuff for primetimer.com. So I did a thing about Los Spookies, which you should definitely check out on HBO, new Spanish language comedy series that Fred Armisen helped create. And speaking of Los Spookies, that is also going to be the topic of this week's Extra Hot Great podcast.
Indeed.
That I will be guesting on, I believe, tomorrow to talk about Los Spookies. So you can find me in those places and other various freelance places on the web. And my own site is terribly-happy.com.
Indeed. Yes, as you are listening to this, listeners, that episode of Extra Hot Great should also have dropped. It and the blotter jump holding hands at the same time every Wednesday morning. So give that a listen. Omar, thank you so much for coming on the show.
I feel so loved. Thank you.
Oh, and now you're well sick of me in your ears at this point.
Oh, no, this is a joy.
Oh, thanks. All right, folks, coming up on The Blotter Presents next time, it's 16 Shots and The Thin Blue Line with Kevin Smokler. After that, you'll be declaring your independence from new content, so I hope you'll enjoy the archives on 4th of July week. And after that, it's the latest from Aaron Lee Carr, I Love You, Now Die, with Eve Beatty, who is also my co-editor on the Best Evidence newsletter. Until all that drops, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's at Blotter Presents, any old where on social. You can become an official Blotter tipster at the Patreon page. That's also patreon.com/blotterpresents. And subscribe to that newsletter, blotterpresents.substack.com. If you like the podcast, I'd love it if you tell a friend and rate it on iTunes. If you don't like the podcast, I'd love it if you kept that to yourself. My guest has been Omar Gayaga, and he is on Twitter at Omar G. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.